What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of state. We don't care. Thanks for tuning in to Out There today. It's Wednesday, June 5th. And for today's show, I have an interview with Robbie Lepser. He's a local filmmaker who's been making documentary films in the Valley for over 40 years. And he has a film out that's screening in Northampton this week called Power Struggle. It's about the citizen effort to close Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. And it's showing on Thursday, June 6th and Friday, June 7th at the Northampton Center for the Arts, 33 Holly Street, at 7 p.m. with panel discussions afterwards on both days. On Friday, one of the panelists will be Francis Crowe. Robbie's also showing a short film about Francis Crowe's 100th birthday, which was back in March, and in a march that happened through Northampton with signs and stuff. All right, here's Robbie.
My name is Robbie Lepser, and I've been a documentary filmmaker for a long time here in the Pioneer Valley.
Like 40 years.
I got an early start when I was 18, when I first came to Hampshire College in 1976. And the very first documentary that I started working on was chronicling the birth of the anti-nuclear power direct action movement at Seabrook, New Hampshire, when 1,414 people got arrested and held in National Guard armories for 2 weeks.
1,400, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And it was a sit-down on the construction site of the nuclear power reactor that was being constructed in Seabrook, New Hampshire, on the coast. And a lot of people from Western Mass were involved in that organizing and that action. It was called the Clamshell Alliance. Yeah. And that action inspired direct action sit-ins and civil disobedience at nuclear power facilities all across the country. Literally, that action lit a fire across the country, and there was huge throughout the rest of the 1970s. This was April of 1977 when that direct action took place. Into the 80s, probably even into the 90s, there was a lot of consciousness in this country about the dangers of nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that at the time, it was all young people. We were all in our 20s at the time. And now, fast forward to the, 20-teens, almost 2020, nuclear power is not on most people's radar screens. Mm-hmm. And when you go to anti-nuclear rallies and events, it's mostly all gray hairs, mm-hmm. you know. But really, it should be on the radar screen of everybody because it is... I'd like to see my film, Power Struggle, help to spread this consciousness around climate justice, that nuclear power should be on the list as well, mm-hmm. with fossil fuels to be banned, that nuclear power should be banned as well because of the inherent dangers.
Mm-hmm. So your film, Power Struggle, it's showing at the Center for the Arts Thursday night?
And... Yeah, it's showing Thursday night at 7 o'clock and Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Northampton Center for the Arts, which is also known as 33 Holly Street, mm-hmm. here in Northampton. And it will also be shown in Brattleboro on Saturday, June 15th at 7 o'clock at the 118 Gallery, which is at 118 Elliott. I mean, I'm sorry, 118 Elliott Gallery, which is at 118 Elliott Street in Brattleboro. And people can find out more information about the film at the film's website, which is powerstrugglemovie.com. And basically what Power Struggle documents now from 1977 forward to 2010 is actually when I first started filming the organizing being done in Western Mass and throughout Vermont to close the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, which is located on the Connecticut River, just a few miles from the Massachusetts border, just across the river from New Hampshire, on the banks of the Connecticut River. And Vermont Yankee was one of the oldest nuclear power plants in the country, and was of the Mark I model, which is the same as Fukushima. Mm-hmm. And so it was very old and deteriorating and dangerous, and it had a long history of problems and leaks, radioactive leaks. Mm-hmm. And so people in Vermont and in Western Mass organized for many, many years. Actually, they've been organizing, opposing the plant since it first opened in 1972. Well, it had a 40-year license that was going to expire in March of 2012. Uh-huh. So the activists actually were able, several years before the license was to expire, I think this was in 2006 even, to get the Vermont legislature to have a say in the future operation of this nuclear power plant. So Vermont was in this very unique position as a result of that activism that led to that law.
So normally would it have been like the NRC or who would make the decision?
Exactly. In almost most places, the nuclear federal agency in charge of nuclear power is the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. All the rules are rigged against localities or states having much of a say-so over the operation of nuclear power plants. But in Vermont, because of the activism and because of this law, Vermont became the only state legislature in the country to have a say-so over the future operation. And how that came to be was that Vermont requires a state license for a nuclear power plant, as they do for all energy projects in the state.
Are they the only state in the nation?
I think they're the only state in the nation that requires a state license for a nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. And so this became a unique opportunity then for the citizens to have a voice through their elected representatives in the state legislature.
Uh-huh. So some citizens were paying attention and looking ahead and be like, we need to get this law changed so we have some power.
Absolutely. They were. They were very forward thinking of that. And I have to credit the Citizens Awareness Network, Deb Katz, who will actually be speaking on Thursday night after the film. We're going to have panels after the film. On Thursday night, Deb Katz and Harvey Shackman from the Citizens Awareness Network, who've been long fighting nuclear power for decades, not only at Vermont Yankee, but Seabrook, and we used to have a nuclear power plant in the Berkshires, in Roe, Massachusetts, that they helped shut down. They'll be speaking along with Clay Turnbull of the New England Coalition. They've been the sort of the main legal interveners over the years. And then on Friday night, we're going to have a very special panel with Frances Crowe, who turned 100 years old just recently. She's been a longtime activist here in Northampton. And she'll be speaking with her affinity group called the Shut It Down Affinity Group. Mm-hmm. It's women all over the age of 70 who just took it upon themselves to say, we're going to go put our bodies on the line here and block the gates of Vermont Yankee to protest. And they went up there dozens of times. And so there, Frances Crowe and her affinity group is prominently featured in my film Power Struggle, and they're going to be speaking after the screening about their experiences as an affinity group in terms of their participation in the movement that did lead to the successful shutdown of Vermont Yankee, as well as I think they have a lot to say about how their model of an affinity group could be useful in any political struggle. Because really, as Frances just said to me as I was visiting her at her house before coming over here, it's all about community. Yeah. And frankly, that's always been a sub-theme in all of my documentaries that have chronicled grassroots social change movements for the last 40 years. To me, the essential part for being successful at making grassroots social change is having a strong community.
Yeah.
So Vermont Yankee shut down in December of 2014. So it's been closed now for 4.5 years, roughly. And what people need to know is that when a nuclear power plant closes down, yes, it's safer because it's not producing new radioactive contamination, mm-hmm. but the problem has not gone away
yeah.
because the most highly toxic wastes known to the planet are in the nuclear waste that is being held at nuclear facilities all around the country,
mm-hmm.
and there's no place to put it. So this high-level toxic poison is going to be staying on the banks of the Connecticut River indefinitely into the future because mm-hmm. there is no place to put it. So people need to know that and know that about nuclear waste in general from all the nuclear power plants across mm-hmm. the world.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the actual demolition or dismantling of the nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. there are risks there because once you start dismantling the buildings, for instance, the concrete, there's radioactivity contamination in the very concrete itself. So there are concerns that people have that in the actual demolition, it could contaminate the area with radioactive dust and particles. And of most concern is right across the street from the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant in Vernon, Vermont, is an elementary school,
yeah.
literally a quarter mile away. And across the river in New Hampshire, there's a middle school and a high school maybe a half mile away.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. people need to keep their eyes alert, eyes and ears alert
yeah.
to what's going on and not think, oh, just because the nuclear power plant is shut down, the problem's gone away. It has not, and so my film Power Struggle ends with this kind of double ending, where on the one hand it was indeed a grassroots victory of activists that really was a major factor, I feel, in why Vermont Yankee shut down. I mean, they say it was uneconomical, and but it was the activism really kind of pushed them over the edge
mm-hmm.
that because of the activism and the scrutiny, they would have had to spend a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
To keep it up to par, and they weren't willing to spend that money.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the activists played a very powerful role in shutting it down. So a lesson from the film is that grassroots activism works, and grassroots democracy, at least in Vermont, works quite well. And so I want to give people some hope around that, because you know how rare it is
mm-hmm.
for
yeah.
grassroots activists to actually
yeah.
have a victory.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I also... The film is a warning that this toxic, high-level radioactive waste is going to be around for 250,000 years,
mm-hmm.
and we have no solution for it. And we keep making this stuff all mm-hmm. around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to have people's consciousness understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to see that be part of the agenda of the climate justice movement. Because it is a major problem.
Did you?
I guess one of my questions might be, are there any other countries that are good models for us in their process of decommissioning nuclear power plants and on-site disposal?
Mm. Well, Germany has actually committed to close down all of their nuclear power plants in the next number of years. And they made that decision after Fukushima. And so they've already closed down, I think, about at least half of their nuclear power plants, I believe, and the rest are slated to close by the mid-2020s. So they've actually made that commitment. And I think Germany really stands as an inspiration to all other countries that this can be done. Interestingly enough, Japan is a kind of unwitting example in that when the nuclear disaster happened at Fukushima, all of the nuclear power plants were then shut down after that. The government of, and initially the Prime Minister of Japan, who was actually kind of had a turn of heart about nuclear power having gone through the disaster, was actually a supporter of keeping them closed and a supporter of a renewable energy future for Japan. But then he lost office, and the prime minister that's been in Japan now for quite a long time, Abe, is really very reactionary, very right-wing. He's in favor of starting up the nuclear power plants. But in Japan, they've actually have this system where they have to actually have local people's approval, local government approvals. So only a handful of nuclear power plants in Japan have restarted. So most of them have been still shut down. And so it's showing that you can live without nuclear power.
We're taught that, at least I feel like the common knowledge is that if we don't have nuclear power, like, where are we going to make up this huge energy need? That's going to be impossible. We'll have to put solar panels over the entire state. I mean, how has Japan done it? Where does electricity come from now?
Well, right now, it is, unfortunately.
Even people can't use, like, less, can they?
Yeah, well, they actually have had to cut back. Mm-hmm. So that's been a major thing in Japan. I was there, actually, and they had to turn off, the lights and the air conditioning and stuff like, well, big deal, you know? But unfortunately, it is true that Japan has had to rely on fossil fuels to make up the difference now. However, there are proposals to increase, and I think it has been increasing, solar energy and renewable energy in Japan. Mm-hmm. But this is the future. I mean, there have been studies that have shown that it is quite possible for the United States by the year 2050 at the latest, but even there are new studies coming out saying we could actually reach this by 2030 to be completely nuclear-free and fossil fuel-free, and through solar energy and wind energy and other renewable energy, as well as efficiency.
Yeah.
So this is where we need to go as a society. We need the so-called Marshall Plan that they mm-hmm. did after World War II, to use an analogy. We need to direct, and that's essentially what the Green New Deal is about, and what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is proposing, is that we need to direct major policy changes to this vision of a Green New Deal for the future of the United States, and thereby be an example for the world. And that would involve not only an energy component that's about clean and safe and renewable and sustainable, but also in terms of social justice. And it's really, it's all connected.
I have a question about the Vermont Yankee thing. So with demolition of the plant, there's all these ongoing hazards or threats, whatever. Has there been any engagement from students, teachers, or parents from the schools right by the plant that you're aware of?
That's a good question. I don't really know. What I do know is that in Vernon itself, the home community of Vermont Yankee, there was a high degree of support for the nuclear power plant,
yeah,
because there was a lot of workers who lived in Vernon who were then part of the whole town government and so forth. So I understand, I can understand that. At the same time, there wasn't a lot of questioning,
yeah,
or questions being raised that really should be raised,
yeah,
about, well, what are the potential health threats and how do we need to look at this?
Yeah.
So I think that's just questions that need to be raised, and
yeah,
just an ongoing assurance and watchdog that while they do this dismantling process, mm-hmm, that's going to span many years, how can we be assured as a public that all the precautions are being met for people's safety? And this is the problem with nuclear power in general, and probably definitely applies to the decommissioning as well, is that because it's a commercial, corporate operation, there's all the incentives in the world to cut corners to save money.
Mm-hmm.
And those corners can be raise the risks for public health in terms of radioactive contamination and potential cancers down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing about nuclear power, is that, the nuclear industry will say, well, there's no immediate danger,
mm-hmm,
if there's a release of radioactivity. Well, that may be true in terms of the immediate danger,
mm-hmm,
but the way cancer works is that the radioactive particles that get released, what's dangerous is the ones that you ingest. Because they can say, well, it's a low dose.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's outside your body, then it may be true, in fact, that it's a relatively low risk to you. But what's really the problem here, and Arne Gunderson, who's a nuclear engineer, who's profiled in my film, and he's gone to Japan and taken soil samples and dust samples from vacuum cleaners hundreds of miles away from Fukushima, and they found these tiny little nanoparticles that are radioactive and highly radioactive. So you could make the argument, or the industry could make the argument, well, this is a low dose. Well, this is the thing, that tiny little radioactive nanoparticle, you breathe in, and it gets lodged in your lungs. Well, it's relatively, you could say, low dose to your whole body, but it's actually very high dose to the cells that it's now lodged in and will stay there for the next 20 years, irradiating those cells, and that's how a cancer develops. So this is the danger and the public health threat from nuclear power, whether it's an operating plant, whether it's a decommissioned plant. And also, I just did a whole series of interviews with indigenous Native American activists from New Mexico, Navajo, and Lakota in South Dakota, who are dealing with, there are 15,000 abandoned open pit uranium mines in the western United States. And this radioactive dust isn't just blowing around and getting in and contaminating the water system and getting into people's lungs. And so there's a high cancer rate. Some of the highest cancer rates in the country are on Native American reservations in the Dakotas and in the Southwest. And so this is another, and this is where this is the beginning of what we call the nuclear fuel cycle. The uranium is what is made into the fuel rods that can that power the nuclear power plant, as well as nuclear bombs.
So people that you interviewed in the Southwest, how are they dealing with this crisis in their community, or this, or the, I mean, like psychologically and legally?
It's a big challenge, and I think in some ways the indigenous activists are really taking the lead. I mean, they're really on the front lines of all kinds of resource extraction. We call it, you know, from the coal and the other minerals, oil and uranium. Whether it's in the United States or elsewhere around the world, indigenous communities are impacted. So this is another way that I'm hoping to educate people. This was through a series that I just recently produced called Power Struggle Continues, which was a series of 4 half-hour, 45-minute interview programs that I did online that was co-hosted by Free Speech TV, that is airing Power Struggle nationally. And they actually asked me to do this kind of follow-up series of kind of like these online panels. So I interviewed on video, Skype or Zoom, and it was on Facebook Live, activists that we looked at nuclear waste, economics, safety, and the impact on indigenous communities. So you can find those videos at my website, again, powerstrugglemovie.com. And for instance, one of the proposals is to site what they're calling interim or temporary high-level nuclear waste dumps in New Mexico and West Texas that are in Latino and indigenous Native American communities. It's just really an outrage. It's really an example of environmental racism. Yeah. And the same thing for the high-level so-called permanent dump is cited for Yucca Mountain in Nevada, which is on Western Shoshone indigenous land. There are problems, environmental problems, with all of these proposals in terms of contamination. The so-called permanent site is not going to work. It's water flows through there over geological time spans and would contaminate the aquifer of drinking water for millions of people. And these temporary so-called waste dumps, people know that once they're there, they're not going to be temporary, they're going to be stuck with them. But then there's the whole other problem of what are called mobile Chernobyls, where you have to transport all of this nuclear waste across the country on highways and rail lines, and it's mostly all in the eastern seaboard to the southwest.
I remember in the late 90s when the compact bill was did pass? Is that So the interstate transport of nuclear waste is allowed now?
I'm not sure. Okay. In fact, I'll be asking the questions of the panelists about this on Thursday night when we show Power Struggle at the Northampton Center for the Arts. Again, it's at 7 o'clock, 33 Holly Street. On Thursday night, there'll be a panel on Vermont Yankee and nuclear waste. And on Friday night, there'll be a panel about the Shut It Down Affinity Group and Francis Crowe talking about their experiences.
Yes, Thursday, June 6th and June 7th.
Yes.
So the waste right now, is it being transported illegally?
No. Right now, the high-level nuclear waste is not being transported.
Okay.
That hasn't been approved yet.
It's just sitting at different nuclear plants on the east.
Yes, it's staying at all the facilities where it was originated from. And there is no plan at this moment. But there are proposals to try to make this waste dump work, at least a temporary one, so-called temporary, under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. So we have to watch out for that. Another problem, I hate to be the bringer of bad news here.
We expected that.
But the waste is being put into what are called dry cast containers, which are these huge concrete and steel giant casts. They weigh many tons. And basically, they're only licensed for, it's either 20 or 40 years, I forget which. And the industry says at best they may last 100 years. Mm-hmm. But again, it's temporary because this waste is dangerous for 250,000 years. So really, it's a temporary solution, and they have no plans of what to do with it next. You know, they're just saying, well, the future generation will deal with that.
And are they liable for only a certain number of years?
Good question. And the other issue is that these casks will probably leak, you know, at some point, whether that's a few decades down the road or more. And so there's no plans for how to deal with that. They're just being left in the open. They're not even being put in berms. They could be subject to terrorist attack. It's crazy. And then the other thing is, in Europe, they go for the more expensive casts that have thicker walls, thicker steel walls, and ability to monitor inside whether it's leaking, whether you have a problem. The American companies, corporations, they don't want to spend the money. And Vermont Yankee doesn't want to spend the money. So they're buying these cheapo Holtec brand dry casts that have very thin steel walls and no ability to monitor whether they're leaking from the inside. I mean, again, they're literally kicking this problem down the road. And we could have a whole new problem in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years of radioactive leaks from these dry casts, and they're just sitting in the open. And we have this nuclear waste dump up the river on the Connecticut River, just over the Massachusetts border in Vermont at Vermont Yankee, indefinitely into the future.
That leaves you kind of speechless. I mean,
yeah, so...
What is it like for you to hear this?
It's stuff that we know and have been involved in some level, but like, I guess my question is, you know, people that you interview or things that you document about this, like, nuclear, whatever, like, it's all, like, the destruction of people getting cancer, everything getting cancer, like, we all know these things, like, in our brains, like, how do we hold all these mm-hmm. things in our brains, like, this thing that's happening all around us, while at the same time, it's just such a beautiful world.
Exactly. And I think that it is important, and I'm glad that you raised this, that we need to all maintain a balance in our lives to not get sucked in, mm-hmm. literally, by this black hole of negative energy. But at the same time, with our eyes wide open to the dangers, we can't dismiss that. For me, I kind of look at it in this way, that, you know, sort of the cards that we were dealt with coming into this human existence is that life on planet Earth is, you know, has some incredible deep wounds of abuse and violence and exploitation and greed and destruction and racism and disrespect of people. At the same time, side by side, there's the most incredible community and love and compassion and art and so I choose to look at what is positive, where's the activism, So I try to do that in Power Struggle. I focus on positive examples of people being active and try to inspire people, despite the challenges. I think we have to work for change, and because if we put our heads in the sand, then we've already given up, you know. And I think that part of being human and part of is living life to its fullest and trying to create community and create the positive world right now, not in the future, right now, where we live.
Yeah. I feel like if you see a monster, you know, some people might be like, oh no, it's going to get me. And some people might be like, I'm grabbing my sword and I'm going for it. it's the challenge. There's work to do. There's no shortage of work to do. So like to be bored in this day and age, or it's just like there's so much living to be done through community and through like, you know, getting together and trying to figure out how we can address some of these.
I think really the lesson for me has always been that people can make a huge difference by just stepping up to the plate. Mm-hmm. And that if everybody steps up to the plate and, you know, and do their part and be part of a community, we can make really radical change in society. And I think that's what is needed. I mean, we need a revolution. And I think, in fact, I feel like we are all already part of this revolution. Yeah. And really it's about just taking it to a new level of organization, of communication, of understanding that the major systems need to change. Mm-hmm. And to me, I've always been inspired by nonviolence as a real deep way of bringing about the change.
I know when I grabbed my sword analogy, I was thinking about the conflict of the nonviolence. Yes. I prioritize nonviolence too. But I meant that in like an athletic kind of way, sport kind of way.
Right. Well, even as a metaphor, you know, I think that we... it's all about, even on an even deeper, bigger level, to me, it's about bringing back a sense of the sacred. Uh-huh. You know, that, and I feel like Native Americans talk about this, the we have to rebuild the broken hoop. Mm-hmm. We have to restore the sacred hoop of life. And really what that means is, and I think the root of our problems on planet Earth is that we've lost a sense of the sacred, because when you stop seeing all life as sacred, then you can see certain people as the other to be abused or exploited, and you see the land to be abused and exploited. Whereas if you see that all life is sacred, then you have to be in solidarity with your brother and your sister and all peoples, and to work to really protect our mother, the earth. I mean, that's really, I feel like, what's at the root of what we need to be about in society.
When I was emptying downtown trash barrels this morning, I found a little fortune cookie, my trash treasure. So I opened it up and the fortune said, we all have much more in common than it seems.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. What you were just saying about a movement, I was also thinking today about how, like, there's so many different roles within a movement. Like, you're a documentarian. and like, some people are organizers, some people are networkers, some people like cook or research or are public speakers, all these things.
Exactly. I want to encourage people to do whatever they feel good at, whatever they feel comfortable at, and it's about building community, for sure.
It was one of the greatest experiences of my life and has set me on kind of this wild trajectory of feeling that we can really set out and accomplish what we intend to do. In the late 90s, I think there were three of us that wanted to protect this ancient forest on public lands.
Where was it?
It was in Oregon.
Hmm.
It fell under the salvage rider, a rider attached to an appropriations bill. To funding for Oklahoma City bombing victims, and the rider said that all of our forests are diseased and dying and we must take immediate repercussions and suspend all environmental laws for 1 year that we can get this cut out in this dead wood. And so all of the forests that we had been protecting for 15, 20 years came up for sale. Like, all of the forests that we had litigated against on public lands, these are public lands, national forest lands, came up for sale in 1 year. And this is when I moved to Oregon, and I had never even seen forests like this, and you would just see a partial tree on a logging truck. And so this was one sale of thousands of sales in the country, and everyone said there's no way you can stop it. And there was just a small ragtag team of three people, and 7 years later, thousands of people were involved. We had the federal Senator Wyden flying in helicopters over the timber sale to see what we were talking about. A third of it was cut, so you could see the blowdown. And finally, we started with city councils, the small local city councils, and went to Portland. It was the drinking watershed for Portland, and worked all the way up to talking to the federal senators. We had to get the signature of the president at the time, Clinton. He was responsible for it to begin with as well. But, you know, there were so many people that said there was no way we could do this. And it took everyone. Everyone was involved from so many directions. And it was just so heartening to feel that, you know. And so...
So you were able to stop part of it?
And we stopped it. Yeah, the two-thirds of it was saved. Mm-hmm. Thousands of acres, 2,000 acres of forest, through tree-sitting, direct action, blocking roads, and education. It was really, really about education and people coming together and going out into the forest. And it was just so much community was created through that.
Yeah, I think an important part of what you say and what Robbie's saying with, like, power struggle and documenting of Vermont Yankee is that in addition to, like, organizing and believing and thinking ahead, also just knowing this could take 6, 8, 10 years. You know, this is like a long-term struggle, and so not to give up just because you don't see the results you need in a couple of years.
Exactly. Having the long-term vision. I mean, like I said, many of the Vermont Yankee activists have been protesting since 1972, over 40 years. And I started filming in 2010. There was kind of a new wave of activism in the 2000s. And then, you know, I myself, in terms of the film, filmed over 5 years, having no idea how the story was going to end up.
Yeah.
I was very thankful for Entergy for giving me an ending by choosing to close the plant. That helped in the storyline of the film.
Yeah.
But then it was several more years of editing, and now it's been several more years of getting the film out through film festivals. And we had, initially we had a sneak preview fundraiser in October of 2016 at the Academy of Music, and then at the Latches Theater. Following that, in November of 2016, where the governor of Vermont at the time, Peter Shumlin, who's profiled in the film, he came. Mm-hmm. So that was a big deal. The film had its official world premiere at the Provincetown Film Festival in June of 2017. Had its official Vermont premiere at the Vermont Film Festival in Burlington in October of 2017. And now, 2019, the film is being aired nationally on Free Speech TV and Link TV, and those are both available on the web, as well as in Vermont, it's being shown on Vermont PBS. And there's a global broadcaster. We haven't signed a contract yet, so I can't say who it is because I'm hoping it'll still go through, but there's a global broadcaster who's interested in airing Power Struggle around the world in 5 different languages: English, French, Spanish, Arabic, and Russian. So that will be really great for me to feel like the work that I'm doing of showing inspiring activists from our area in Western Mass and in Vermont to have that message go all around the world. And that's what I'm hopeful for, and that's what I'm working for in terms of these screenings. Again, it's Friday and Thursday and Friday, June 6th and 7th at the Northampton Center for the Arts, 33 Holly Street, at 7 o'clock. Our fundraisers for the film as well, and we're trying to raise money to really take the film to schools, to community groups, and libraries all across the United States. And so we're trying to raise money for that. And for people who want to help out, you can go to the website again, powerstrugglemovie.com, and there's a donate button there and more information about the film. You can see a trailer and read all sorts of things about the film, lots of reviews and other articles. And as I said, this series that I did called Power Struggle continues the series of interview programs I did with activists all around the country, because we wanted to sort of take this story from Vermont and then say, which is what the film is about, Power Struggle, the feature film, and say, all right, how does this issue relate all across the country in terms of a deeper dive into the nuclear issue? Like I said, dealing with nuclear waste, nuclear economics, nuclear safety, and impact on indigenous people. So those videos, Power Struggle Continues, is on the, you can find that on the website.
Thanks a lot for coming out today, Robbie. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to say before we end?
Well, I just want to, just applaud all the work that, you know, you all have been doing, and especially, you know, on Valley Free Radio. I mean, we really need independent media, and the work of Valley Free Radio is really important aspect of that, to have a conversation like this that we can, you know, talk about social change and have that be available for people to listen to and hopefully be inspired to, and then figure out, somebody listening, how can they connect to what issues that they want to be part of. Again, it's all about community. I really feel that that is an essential element for social change, and it's really, frankly, the reason why I've stayed in this valley now for over 40 years, mm-hmm. is because we have developed throughout the entire, you know, Pioneer Valley, a really close-knit community of activists and people who care and people of consciousness and artists, and to really come together to work to make major change. And so I think that, and frankly, many of my films have been chronicling this. And so I'm hoping actually later in the year to have a retrospective series of screenings at the Northampton Center for the Arts, and also the Shea Theater and Turner's Falls and other places where I can show some of this history of change here in the Valley. Just to mention briefly, a previous film that I did is called The Peace Patriots, which chronicled the major protests in the Pioneer Valley against the Iraq War when it first started. Also, another film I did is called An Act of Conscience, which is the story of war tax resistors Randy Keeler and Betsy Corner, whose house was seized by the IRS for their refusal to pay war taxes as a protest against war and military spending. And I filmed their whole saga over many years.
I think I saw that one.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel like there's a lot of rich history here in this valley and a lot of activism to point to. So I welcome, you know, the opportunity to, you know, this is my contribution for change, making these films to inspire people. And once again, for anybody listening, I'm showing Power Struggle, the film that I've worked on for many years now. It's a feature-length documentary chronicling the successful grassroots citizens' effort to close the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. It profiles many activists from our area, including Francis Crowe, who just recently turned 100. And I'll be showing a short film along with Power Struggle called Francis Turns 100, which is about her birthday march through the streets of Northampton when she just turned 100 a few months ago in March. So this is all happening on Thursday and Friday, June 6th and 7th, at the Northampton Center for the Arts, 33 Holly Street, at 7 o'clock. And then again in Brattleboro on Saturday, June 15th, at 118 Elliott Gallery, which is on at 118 Elliott Street in Brattleboro, also at 7 o'clock. And again, you can find out all information about this at the film's website, where you can watch a trailer and buy tickets also. So again, that's powerstrugglemovie.com.
So you've been listening to an interview with Robbie Lepser, filmmaker of the film Power Struggle, which is screening here in Northampton tomorrow, Thursday, June 6th, and Friday, June 7th, at the Northampton Center for the Arts at 33 Holly Street, 7 p.m. And there's going to be panel discussions after each film. And there's also going to be a special tribute to Francis Crowe. a premiere screening of a short film, Frances Turns 100, about her 100th birthday protest march through the streets of Northampton back in March. Power Struggle is about the citizen effort to close Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Here on Valley Free Radio. You can listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. And this Saturday and every Saturday, the Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue in Northampton. You can come and learn how to fix your bike or just borrow tools. I'm usually there, or Dwayne is there. You can learn to fix your bike, use tools, scavenge parts. There may be some used bikes for sale. And if you just want to come to meet bike people. So Democracy Now! Is coming up at 5 o'clock. This is John Hall.